History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then take the time to listen as memories which may not have seen the light of day in decades start to come to the forefront again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Out of the nearly 327 million people in the United States, it's estimated that only about 100,000 are centenarians, men and women who have reached their 100th birthdays. That's just 0.03% of the population, or 3 out of every 10,000 Americans. In other words, it's pretty unique, and we have the privilege of meeting a unique World War II veteran today who celebrated his 100th birthday this past week in Clovis, California. Some of the folks who saw footage of the surprise birthday parade in front of the home of Dr. Gilbert Stocks may have recognized him as their eye doctor. He was an optometrist in Central California for more than 40 years, a career made possible in part by his service as a Navy pilot. But to put this newly minted centenarian's life in perspective, we need to go back to the beginning in St. Charles, Arkansas.
St. Charles, Arkansas is on the bank of the White River. At the time I was born, it had about 200 people. Look forward to 100 years and the population, about 200 people. But, that was a good time for old Joe. I mean, the population included him because he would sit out, lean against the wall in his chair, spitting tobacco juice to flies. And he was doggone good because he would get, 9 out of 10 of them. So he was pretty good. My dad died when I was 2 years old. And then when my mother remarried, I became the poster child for stepchildren. And I was raised by a man who was very, very strict, especially with me. So most stuff that the kids got into was my fault. Then as we grew older, we began to get more and more used to each other. So by the time I left home, pretty well settled. I was raised in the Depression, and so when I graduated from high school in 1940, I realized that that was all the education they were going to give me. If I wanted additional education, I was going to have to get it myself. So I got to go to college in Conway, Arkansas, which was Arkansas State Teachers College. I think I started a college, there were less than $100. But luckily, at that time, anybody that finished high school could go to state college. And maybe that's why I got in, I don't know. But anyway, I went up there. They're going to give me a job of milking cows in the college dairy because I was good at that. I had milked cows at home, so I knew how to do it. I knew which end to work. So that went on for a few months. Our residence was above the dairy, and we took meals from one of the employees' wife from his house. So we would go over there and have their meals. So I made the mistake. His wife says, "Well, do you like pork and beans?" Yeah, I love pork and beans. Well, I shouldn't have said that because, my God, we had pork and beans 3 meals a day. Breakfast, dinner, and supper. We call it supper back there. So about that time, we were milking cows as we came to them. So the guy in charge of the dairy there says, "Well, I'm going to change it a little and divide the herd up, and we'll draw numbers for cows And that's the cow that you will milk all the time. There was one cow called Mary. She was the worst cow in the whole doggone herd. Oh, God, I hope I don't get that cow. Oh, I hope I don't get that cow. I got that cow. So the round we went, we would go down and milk, and her udder would practically drag the ground, and her teats were chapped and sore and cracked. I caught a squeeze on her, and she would kick me. I'd kick her back, and she'd kick me, and I'd kick her back. Then she'd put her foot in the milk bucket and rattle it around, and she wouldn't let me put my foot in there. So this went on for a while, and I was getting a little tired of it. Now, this, I am kind of poor on dates. This was in 1941. So there was a unit there that in Conway that got called up, but one of the guys worked in the cafeteria. I said, by golly, that'll be a good way for me to get out of this dairy business. So I hightailed it to the cafeteria, and I talked to the woman in charge. I didn't quite get down on my knees, but anyway, I walked away with the job. So I says, Mary, bye-bye. So I moved to the campus, but they had a program that was discontinued just before I got there. It was a program that the government thought up of doing something. I don't know what it was, but anyway, they spent some money, and then I guess when the money ran out, they quit. Then when I got there from the dairy, they didn't have any room. Well, where are they going to put me? They're not going to put me on the door. So this former program had stored all of their tables and desks, beds and mattresses and so forth in the cellar. So they said, well, we'll have to put you in the cellar. Okay, so that's where I was, and I was the only one down there for a whole semester. So I was kind of isolated, but hey, you know, it was a roof over my head. They had a civilian pilots training program there that we flew Piper Cubs, and I had always wanted to fly, and when I got there in freshman year, well, I'm going to join that. I said, well, you can't join it until you're a sophomore. Well, next year I hightailed it, and I got in. So I was making the flights as well as working in the cafeteria. So they had that in two divisions. They had it in a primary and a secondary. The primary was the Piper Cub, and the secondary was a Waco.
I do have a question for you.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned you came up through the Depression, and most people alive today weren't alive during the Depression and have no idea what things were really like. So I'm just wondering if you have a few memories from those years that kind of stand out as being indicative of the way things were, the way the economy was.
Yeah, I remember there was one winter that we lived on sorghum molasses and homemade bread. That's all we had to eat. We were lucky. We were living on a farm, so we had eggs and milk. But people in town, I don't understand how they got along, because we were able to raid part of our food. But yeah, I can remember that as well. My mom was baking the bread, and you get that good old freshly made bread smell, and get that in a pot of molasses and go to it. So that was quite common, and it took a long time for the forest to work out of the Depression up from the time the war was over. So yeah, it was pretty rough.
And another thing you said, you mentioned that you always wanted to fly. Can you pinpoint or go back to when that developed for you? Was there something that kind of lit that spark for you?
I remember when I saw my first airplane, I was standing outside by our house. It was a little four-room house, and I was about 3, maybe 4 years old. And I heard this zoom, zoom, zoom. What in the world is that? And I happened to look up, and here was this airplane flying across, Couldn't been over 300 feet. I don't know what he was flying that low for, but he was flying low and slow and just went right straight on across. I don't know where he went, never heard of him again or anything. He was just passing through. So I said, by golly, I want to fly one of those. And from then on, I was hooked. And all through high school, yeah, I want to fly an airplane. Because one of my play in the Navy band. So that was what we wanted to do. And finally, eventually, that's what we got to do.
And you're talking about being there at Conway. At Arkansas State, and you were in the civilian pilot training program. So this is all still before Pearl Harbor?
The pilot training was, yeah, but it was awfully close because I was out on a solo flight when I came in, and my instructor says, the Japs bombed Pearl Harbor. I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. And then told her in Hawaii, well, I didn't really know where Hawaii was, out in the Pacific someplace, you see. And then I figured, well, that's going to change things, by golly. And for once, I was right.
I'm always fascinated by how people heard that news, because I've heard all kinds of stories of where they were and how that news of Pearl Harbor came to them. So you're actually in the air, you land, and they tell you what's happened.
Yeah.
How did you see that change in things after that?
Well, about that time, the Navy had a program which they called the V-7 program. Now, what that was, if you were a junior in college in good standing, you could get in, or you could take the program and test and see if you could get in flight training. So I wanted to get in it, but said, no, I can't get in it because I was a sophomore. So that went on and was going to sign up, but the government was going to let us finish our school year. So I would be a qualified junior. So that's when I got in. So I got this letter from the government giving me 30 days to get in. So I said, oh, gee whiz. I either had the choice of getting in or getting drafted. I ain't going to get drafted if I can get out of it. So there was myself and two other guys. One was Price and the other one was, I can't think of his name. So we decided that, well, we're going to go to the Navy. So we hitchhiked. Back then, you know, traffic wasn't too bad. If you wanted anything, you just about had to hitchhike, especially if you was a student. So we hitchhiked to Little Rock, which is about 75 miles from Conway, and we took the test. And we passed the test. Well, that's pretty good. So we're going to send you to New Orleans for additional testing. Okay, because I'd never been to New Orleans. In fact, I'd never been out of the state. So we went down there and we passed and then we signed the papers. So from then on, our butts belonged to the Uncle Sam for the year plus 6 months. But, you know, there was oddballs everywhere. Everybody has oddballs even then. Because I remember there was one guy that loved to read. After he soloed, he'd go out on a solo flight and he'd take a book with him and he'd read the book while he was flying the airplane. Another one was in my class. He was a little Cajun. He stood about 5'4" or 5", something like that. But he was really weird, so he had a solo flight. He just lived up the road a little ways, so he flew up to show his parents and friends up there what he could do. Well, when he come back, he had the corn stalks between the guy wires holding the two wings on the airplane. You know, it was corn stalks. Hey, Dufour, what in the world did you do? Yeah, well, I just got a little low.
That must have been in a steerman, maybe?
Yeah, that was a steerman. We had steermans the rest of the way for our primary. Also, it probably is not known, but at that particular time, the Navy had its own aircraft factory. They were making the basic trainers. They call them the NP-1s. and it was a lousy one. It looked like the Dickens, and they had a glide angle of a brick. I mean, you cut the throttle and it didn't hang around and change altitudes.
So if you can fly that, you can fly anything, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Finally, I did manage to get through primary, so then they was going to send our class to Pensacola. We left with our blues on, your nice, clean, white shirts, and they put us on a train that ran from New Orleans to Pensacola. And it must have been the last one that they made in 1880, because it had wicker seats, it had a pot-bellied stove in one end of the car, you know, and that's it. No air conditioning, you had to raise the windows, and the engine was kicking out all of this soot and cinders. By the time that we got to Pensacola, we were wearing dark gray shirts. That was a mess, yeah. From the basic, we transferred to intermediate, and this was the first airplane that gave us a feeling of what service aircraft was like. It was you've heard of the SNJ or T's. SNJ was the Navy. Yeah, well, this one was the same as SNJ, only had fixed landing gear. We call it the SNV vibrator because the tail from the cockpit back was made out of plywood. It was quite a bit slower than the SNJ, so went through that. I had that, and then I went to instrument flying. They gave us instrument flying for a short period of time just to get us touched up. Then they gave us an option, and I was surprised that the Navy would give you options. They're going to tell you what to do. And so we had the option between fighter, dive bomber, torpedo bomber, patrol bomber, observation, and then any auxiliary they might have. So the first three, the fighter, the torpedo, and the dive bomber, all flew off aircraft carriers. And so I said, well, no, I think I would rather be a patrol bomber pilot.
And that's exactly what he would become. But little did Gilbert Stocks understand at the time how much that choice could change his life. It's time for our first break. But when we come back, we'll bring more of that picture into focus with this 100-year-old retired optometrist. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.